Nuclear waste. What a dump. The debris left over from the nuclear fuel cycle, especially highly radioactive fuel rods removed from nuclear reactors, remains deadly to life for thousands of years. So what to do about this endless waste stream? That's the question the nuclear industry hates being raised, because, really, they have no viable solution. But they like to pretend that they do, because that allows them to kick the problem decades down the road, by which time the current batch of overpaid nukesters will have retired and are off the hook. Right now, there is no permanent storage site available, so they're trying to convince us that putting this radioactive material in a holding pattern, a so-called interim storage site, is just the ticket. And they're pushing hard for two of these to be opened, one in New Mexico and one in West Texas, only 40 miles away. What could go wrong? Plenty. And it takes a genuine expert to point out just one aspect of the failings of the system. And when he tells you,
if they could get away with both dumps, they would. That would be now over 200,000 metric tons of storage capacity. And we only have 95,000 metric tons of commercial waste right now. So what are they planning for? Our experts asked in these proceedings, are they planning for military wastes, not just civilian nuclear power? Are they planning for other countries' wastes to be imported? None of those questions were ever answered. So we have to assume, yes, possibly yes.
And there is so much more that's wrong with these so-called interim dumps. Well, when Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear, explains exactly what's at stake now that the Supreme Court has opened the way for these two dumps in the Southwest to proceed, you begin to see the forever nature of what we face from that terrible, awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog, some would say bulldog, for Beyond Nuclear. He's someone who knows where the nukesters are trying to bury the bodies of waste in the Southwest and all the reasons why that's not a particularly good idea. In light of this month's Supreme Court ruling that reversed a lower court decision blocking these two new toxic radioactive sites, Camps highlights the issues involved and exactly why they are a really bad idea, not just for those two states, but for the entire country. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than failed mayoral candidate Andrew Cuomo will ever have the chance to tell the people of New York. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, June 24th, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. The big story this week, of course, has been the U.S. bombing of three nuclear sites in Iran. Operation Midnight Hammer, as it was known, included B-2 stealth bombers that dropped more than a dozen bunker buster bombs, 30,000-pound bombs, on the heavily fortified Fordo Uranium Enrichment Site, believed to be 80 meters or 260 feet below ground. American planes also bombed the Natanz uranium enrichment complex, while Tomahawk missiles were reportedly used to strike the Isfahan uranium conversion facility. Fordo is believed by Western powers to be the location where Iran could be working on producing nuclear weapons. However, the International Atomic Energy Agency had reiterated as recently as a day before this latest attack that, according to International Atomic Energy Agency General Secretary Rafael Grossi, quote, "We did not find in Iran elements to indicate that there is an active, systematic plan to build a nuclear weapon." Approximately 1 hour after the strike started, Trump announced what had happened via a tweet on Truth Social. His formal White House address took place about an hour and a half after that, and he said, quote, "The strikes were a spectacular military success. Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated," end quote. But have they? It appears that above-ground buildings in Natanz, Fordo, and Isfahan have been severely damaged. No radiation leaks have been reported by the IAEA, and therefore damage to underground facilities may be limited. Satellite imagery shared by Amit Siegel, a political analyst in Israel, showed a large convoy near the remote mountainside nuclear facility in Fordo 2 days before the U.S. strike, leading to speculation that enriched uranium was being removed to a covert facility. Even Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, has admitted that he does not know whether Iran's nuclear capabilities have been destroyed completely. In an interview on Monday, June 23rd, between NPR's Michelle Martin speaking with Farzan Sabet of the Geneva Graduate Institute, Sabet said, "The impact of bombing has meaningfully set back Iran's ability to quickly acquire nuclear, to acquire weapons-grade uranium, which it would need to build a bomb. But critically, Iran still retains its roughly 400-kilogram stockpile of high-enriched uranium, or HU, which is enriched to around 60%, as well as backup facilities and centrifuge capacity that could be up and running in as little as a few weeks or months. I've seen some estimates that say Iran would be able to use its 400 kilograms of HU to create enough weapons-grade uranium for 9 to 10 weapons in as little as 6 months, should it choose to do so." Concerns remain about Iran's only operating civil reactor at Bushehr. Even before the American incursion, Russia, which built and operates Bushehr, had warned the Israelis of the grave risks of another Chernobyl-style disaster should they strike the reactor. Fears of catastrophe rippled through the Gulf on June 19, when the Israeli military said it had struck a site at Bushehr, only to say later that the announcement was a mistake. Israel says it wants to avoid any nuclear disaster, even though a day after the American bombing raid, Israel launched more attacks on Iran, including Bushehr province. To put this in perspective, the consequences of a successful bombing raid on a civil nuclear plant, such as Bushehr, could include widespread release of highly harmful and persistent radiation, forcing mass and permanent evacuations, and sickening and killing thousands or more in both the near and long term. Multiple warnings from Russia, including from former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, cautioned that Israeli attacks targeting Iranian nuclear facilities risk causing a catastrophic nuclear accident similar to the 1986 Chernobyl meltdown. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons condemned the illegal attack by two nuclear-armed countries, the United States and Israel, on Iran, and called it a dangerous escalation that has undermined the prospects for successful talks on Iran's nuclear program and in the long term risks further conflict threatening civilian lives. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov labeled the reports about the potential U.S. use of tactical nuclear weapons as speculative, warning that such an action would be catastrophic. There is a tremendous amount of information on this, and the story keeps evolving daily. Next week, Nuclear Hot Seat will feature an interview with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, who will go over the different levels of uranium enrichment and what they can mean in terms of the construction of possible bombs in Iran. And we will have links to several Roundup articles, including the ICAN talking points, a Reuters report on what are the nuclear contamination risks from attacks on Iran, and a map which shows which U.S. states are most likely to survive nuclear war. Always good to know. In other U.S. news, as the extremely mislabeled Big Beautiful Bill comes up for a vote, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri is pushing for passage of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, as part of that bill. RECA is not a new law. It was first enacted in 1990 to cover those exposed to nuclear weapons testing during the Cold War and compensate victims of nuclear radiation exposure. Hawley said, "This isn't an act of God. This isn't a freak of nature. This is the federal government dumped nuclear radiation and nuclear toxins into our soil, into our water in Missouri. It's still there. And an expansion of RECA would offer monetary relief for victims and expand it to include Missouri, Alaska, Kentucky, and Guam." And now, for a piece of nuclear numnutsery, here's...
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numnuts of the Week!
New York Governor Kathy Hochul made a big announcement on June 16 that she wants to bring new public nuclear power back to the state. Specifically, Hochul directed the New York Power Authority, the state's power agency, to develop at least 1 gigawatt of new nuclear capacity upstate. While the New York City region hasn't had a nuclear power plant since then-Governor Andrew Cuomo shut down the Indian Point plant in 2021, with good reason, just search Indian Point on Nuclear Hot Seat to learn all the gory details, there are 3 nuclear power plants currently operating in the northern part of the state: Jinnah, Fitzpatrick, and 9 Mile Point. Hochul's announcement did not specify a design or even a location for the new plant, let alone a timeline. But there were some hints. The press release describes, quote, "At least 1 new nuclear energy facility with no less than 1 gigawatt of electricity." While 1 gigawatt is the capacity of a Westinghouse AP1000, and that's the large light water reactor built at Plant Vogtle in Georgia, the explanation seems to leave room for the possibility of multiple smaller facilities. So what's wrong with either of these scenarios? Let me count the ways. First, let's look at the timeline. If the Gov is going after a larger facility like Plant Vogtle, its 2 recent units began construction in 2009, but didn't begin operations until 2023 and 2024. That's 14 years to build Unit 3 and 15 years for Unit 4, and that's with existing plans in place. That would put the due date for anything nuclear started now in New York as 2040. And the cost? Vogtle ended up costing taxpayers in Georgia $34 billion with a B dollars. Not exactly a quick and efficient and economic way out of the current energy crunch in New York State. But hey, maybe she's talking about small modular nuclear reactors, SMNRs, the mini-me's of the nuclear industry. But that brings up a whole different set of problems. The first being, they don't exist! Well, except in PowerPoint presentations and the hallucinations of greedy nuclear industry execs. There is no design that has been approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. None of these reactors have been built, so there's no proof of concept. And there are literally dozens of designs competing for regulatory approval and commercial viability. It's all still on the drawing boards. So how is something that doesn't exist going to solve New York's energy issues? And why is Governor Hochul ignoring the existing wind-water-solar combo, all genuine renewables with technology that exists, that is proven and just has to be implemented so it can start addressing the problem in months as opposed to years, if not decades. What's the matter, Kathy? Don't genuine renewables offer enough graft to make it attractive? Well, Governor Hochul didn't even think through her optics for the announcement, delivering her line standing in front of the Robert Moses Niagara Power Plant, the largest hydropower plant in the Western Hemisphere, a genuinely renewable energy resource. And that's where she's announcing some phantasm of future nuclear? Mixed metaphors, anyone? But nothing stopping Gov Hochul from joining the bandwagon for the non-existent technology as a fix for current problems. Heck, if this scheme even gets off the ground, she doesn't need to worry. She undoubtedly won't be governor or possibly even in politics by the time the ultimate delays and disillusionments of nuclear saviorhood make themselves known. And all of this is why, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York and your plans to build new nuclear, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, nuclear is certainly in the forefront of the news these days. And that hot button is being pushed by news stories, many of them ranging from ill-informed and naive to hysterical and warmongering. Now is not the time to deal in approximations of the nuclear truth. We need hard facts from knowledgeable, genuine experts, and that's what you're going to get from Nuclear Hot Seat. Starting next week, we'll have interviews to help you understand the risks that are being taken in the Middle East and even the science of uranium enrichment. Just how hot does Iran's uranium have to be before it can be used in a bomb? Different perspectives than what you might be getting from mainstream media to help you understand what's happening, why, and even a bit of what can be done about it. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we seek to provide verifiable nuclear information and interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you stories of activists on the front lines around the world, their triumphs and challenges, and what any one of us can do to join these efforts. But Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without your support, meaning donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, the exact right time to donate would be right now. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so please don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com and donate. Know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. The lack of a permanent repository for high-level nuclear waste, the kind that's left over in nuclear reactor spent fuel rods, has become a contentious battle to keep the highly radioactive material off native lands and off transportation routes that go through our cities. While two dumps in the Southwest, West Texas and New Mexico, have been proposed, approved, then blocked by a lower court, the Supreme Court last week reversed the previous decision and given the dumps the go-ahead. What does this mean? Why is it not a good thing? And what is being done about it? To find out, I spoke with Kevin Camps. He is radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. Kevin specializes in high-level waste management and transportation, new and existing reactors, decommissioning, environmental and public health risks associated with government and industry efforts to dump commercial irradiated fuel rods on Native American lands in western United States. I spoke with Kevin Camps on June 20th, 2025. Kevin Camps, it's always good to have you with us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Good to be here. Thank you.
We need some background first. What are the consolidated interim storage facilities that are proposed in West Texas and New Mexico?
The biggest nuke waste dumps on the planet. Texas would be 40,000 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel. There's about 95,000 metric tons of commercial irradiated nuclear fuel in the United States as we speak. It increases by 2,000 metric tons per year because of 94 operating reactors. The New Mexico facility, Holtec, Consolidated Interim Storage Facility, would be much larger than the one in Texas. It would be up to 173,000 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel. So these are temporary dumps, supposedly, according to the companies, according to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They'll only be in operation for maybe 40 years, and maybe they'll get a 40-year extension. So that's 80 years. But there's no permanent repository. There won't be one. I thought the date that Department of Energy was saying was 2048, but I just had a meeting with the Department of Energy a week or two ago, and they said, no, the new date's 2065. So the date for a permanent repository keeps retreating ever further into the future. They were supposed to have one in 1998, but that didn't happen. So these are de facto permanent surface storage facilities for highly radioactive waste. These containers they're in are going to fail eventually. They're only made of steel and concrete. So they're going to breach and release their contents unless they're replaced over and over and over and over again into the future. And where's the money going to come from for that? Where's the institutional control? Will the U.S. still be a government at the time? I mean, we are 250 years old. This material is deadly for a million years into the future. That's a lowball estimate.
When they say interim, they're talking about a temporary storage facility before going to the permanent storage facility, which does not exist. What would be the possible problems that would show up if these containers, if this waste is allowed to be stored on site and then remains there for longer than they're currently telling us?
These containers are vulnerable, fragile, of questionable structural integrity, and defective when they're brand new. So let's take Holtec containers. Whistleblowers in industry and even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission blew the whistle way back in January of 2000 about the questionable structural integrity of Holtec containers for irradiated nuclear fuel when they're brand new. And why is that? Because of flagrant and widespread quality assurance violations associated with their manufacture in the first place. So an example would be the welds on these containers are questionable and actually violate industry and regulatory standards. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission had never found any such problems. When these problems were called to the attention of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they just shrugged their shoulders and said, well, so whatever. They allowed the Holtec containers to be used. They're very commonly used in the United States. I think there are some thousands of loaded Holtec containers. These are multi-purpose canisters for storage on site at nuclear power plants, for transport to dump sites, for storage at interim storage facilities. Holtec would even have you believe that these canisters could be buried at a permanent repository, but the whistleblowers questioned their integrity when brand new. So they're going to fail at some point.
If these storage facilities are allowed to go forward, these interim, so-called interim storage facilities, what are some of the problems attendant on their being there and being located in the south, central, western part of the United States?
The Permian Basin, for one thing, is the most active oil field in the world, more active than Saudi Arabia. So you have oil and natural gas mining extraction happening in the immediate vicinity. You've got potash mining right next to the Holtec site in New Mexico. So these are industrialized zones. And so there could be industrial accidents either at the nuclear waste storage site or its immediate neighbors, including during transportation. So the high-level radioactive waste would be on the rails in the area with oil and natural gas and other flammable and explosive chemical substances. You've got a very volatile natural setting. It's already an earthquake zone that's being made significantly worse by such activities as fracking. So you're having significant earthquakes out there. There was a question asked during the licensing of the Holtec facility. The hearing was held in Albuquerque in January of 2019. one of the licensing judges from the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, Trikouros, asked, what if the entire site subsides under the nuclear waste storage facility? Because potash mining is extensive and they've had subsidence. The fossil fuel industry is causing subsidence. He asked the question, no answer was ever given. And apparently he was okay with no answer being given to his question because he signed off on the dump. All of the licensing board judges did. So did the NRC staff. So did the NRC commissioners. So we've got a rubber stamp agency and the Supreme Court majority, a 6-3 ruling this week, just empowered and enabled this rogue agency to keep on going, keep on acting like you've been acting. It's incredible because the oil company opposed to the dumps, Fasken, tried very mightily for over a decade to enter the NRC licensing proceeding as a party. And the NRC said, nope, 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 you're not a party, get lost. And the Supreme Court majority just said, well, you're not a party, so what are you doing here? I think Justice Gorsuch, in his dissent that was supported by Alito and Thomas, put it well. He said, fox meet henhouse. The NRC is the fox guarding the henhouse. It can decide who's a party, who's not, and it rarely, if ever, allows opponents to these proposals to become a party to a proceeding. So the NRC has immense power to prevent any of us from ever getting our day in court. But what's great is, even in this ruling, it was said repeatedly, this is how you have to behave if you want to be a party to an NRC licensing proceeding. And guess what? Beyond Nuclear has behaved in just that way for over a decade now, and we fully intend to pursue our appeal at the DC Circuit Court of Appeals against Holtec. So we'll see how this goes. We've done everything the Supreme Court majority and dissent said was necessary. And we're going to keep on doing it, and we're going to try to stop the Holtec dump. We're still going to try to stop the Texas dump, despite this ruling, and we'll see what happens. But the fox is guarding the henhouse, as many of us have known for a long time.
Let's roll this back just a little bit to give a sequence. Were these two dumps linked with each other, or were they done separately? And when were they first proposed, and what have been the rulings? What's the chain of history on the rulings back and forth about them?
The Texas dump was initially called Waste Control Specialists. That's the name of a low-level radioactive waste dump that exists in Andrews County, Texas. And then it went bankrupt, and then it reemerged a couple years later as Interim Storage Partners. That low-level waste dump is still out there, Waste Control Specialists, but the high-level interim storage facility is now called Interim Storage Partners. The lead partner is Orano of France. And Waste Control Specialists is a partner in the proposal. And they applied initially in 2016. They went bankrupt. That slowed them down. In 2018, they reapplied for this high-level waste storage license. So that was 2016, 2018. Holtec comes along in 2017 with a very similar proposal for high-level radioactive waste consolidated interim storage in southeastern New Mexico, just 40 miles to the west of the Texas site. These two sites are joined at the hip. They're very similar in nature. They're like two heads of the same monster. In fact, the CEO of Holtec, Krishna Singh, said at their unveiling of their license application press conference on Capitol Hill was April 1st of 2017, Nuclear Fool's Day. And he said, I don't see the Texas dump as competition. I see it as complementary. And my read on that is this is a cabal. These companies are a cabal. They're in it together. If they could get away with both dumps, they would. That would be now over 200,000 metric tons of storage capacity. And we only have 95,000 metric tons of commercial waste right now. So what are they planning for? Our experts asked in these proceedings, are they planning for military wastes, not just civilian nuclear power? Are they planning for other countries' wastes to be imported? None of those questions were ever answered. So we have to assume, yes, possibly yes. And so we've been fighting these proposals since 2016. Even before that, it was called the Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future in the Obama administration, hosted at the Department of Energy, coming up with a plan B now that Yucca was stopped. And their plan B, unfortunately, these 15 panelists on the Blue Ribbon Commission was consolidated interim storage facilities. And away we go. And here come these companies. They're just doing what the Blue Ribbon Commission said needed to happen. And we fought it at NRC for many long years in the licensing proceedings, at the environmental reviews. We were ignored by the NRC at every turn. Then it came time to go to federal court, and we did. And the federal courts, for the most part, ruled against us. But amazingly, in the Fifth Circuit, New Orleans, in 2023, they ruled in favor of the state of Texas, an opponent to the dumps. They ruled in favor of Fasken Land and Minerals, an opponent to the dumps. And that's what just got overruled this week by the Supreme Court. They said the Fifth Circuit was wrong. So now we've lost at the DC Circuit. We've lost at the 10th Circuit in Denver. Our victory, our side in the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans has just been overruled. But like I said, Beyond Nuclear will continue to pursue its appeal against Holtec at the DC Circuit, where we've lost in the past repeatedly. But now we've got this Supreme Court roadmap that says this is how it needs to be done. And we'll show this roadmap to the DC Circuit and say, look, we have followed all the rules as the Supreme Court has laid it down. We would like our day in court, please.
This ruling that came from the Supreme Court was in connection with the proposed Texas dump. What is the current status of the New Mexico dump?
Actually, that Fifth Circuit victory that's now been overturned was not only about the Texas dump, it was also about the New Mexico dump, amazingly. Initially, the Court of Appeals in New Orleans ruled against the Texas dump, and then the Fasken folks, their outside counsel, asked that same court, hey, look, these two dumps are almost identical, Your Honors. What do you have to say about the New Mexico dump that we also oppose? And the Fifth Circuit Court said, we oppose that one too. It's illegal. So both dumps were deemed illegal by the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, both dump companies appealed to the Fifth Circuit and were ruled against again. So the Fifth Circuit was consistent in its rulings against these dumps. The Supreme Court just overturned that, overruled that. So the status of the New Mexico dump is that the NRC licensed it in 2023, and we appealed to the courts, and we took our case to the DC Circuit. We only have limited resources, so we can't go all over the country to all the different circuits. So we went to the DC Circuit, and we have lost there. We lost in the Texas proceeding. We've thus far lost in the New Mexico proceeding, but we are appealing to, and this is yet to be decided, if we will ask the three-judge panel in the DC Circuit to reconsider its ruling based on X, Y, and Z, including this Supreme Court ruling just now. And perhaps we will then have to appeal to, it's called en banc. It's the entire DC Circuit. It's 15 or so judges. And we're going to keep doing this because we feel that our case is meritorious and that we should be victorious. We should prevail in our appeals. And our case is based on the Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1983 as amended, as well as the Administrative Procedure Act. And one of our key arguments is that private storage of Department of Energy owned waste is not legal. It's clearly said in the Nuclear Waste Policy Act that that can't happen. And yet that's the elephant in the room with these dumps, is Holtec and Interim Storage Partners are wanting to store Department of Energy owned waste. They want a title transfer from the nuclear utility companies to the Department of Energy, and they want the federal government to pay them a lot of money to provide this interim storage. That's what these companies want to do. That's their business model. In fact, they had said it explicitly, and we called them on it, and we said, that's illegal what you're saying. Under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, they revised their applications to NRC and said, oh, well, we would store DOE waste. We would store privately owned waste by private companies. We'd store any waste. So they have an illegal provision in their license applications and now their licenses saying DOE owned waste. And we've called them on that repeatedly for years. We brought that up continuously in the courts. You can't have illegal provisions in a license. And we're sticking by that argument.
What is the position of the state of New Mexico and the state of Texas regarding these proposed interim waste storage facilities?
Both states are adamantly opposed to both dumps. In fact, They passed laws, Texas in September of 2021 and New Mexico in March of 2023, prohibiting these dumps from happening in their states. And that includes prohibiting state agencies from issuing needed state permits for these dumps to be constructed and operated. So here we go again. When these laws get in the way of these dumps breaking ground, the dump companies, perhaps even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Department of Justice, can be expected to challenge these state laws and say that this is federally preempted. States can't block these dumps with state laws. That's a federal prerogative. And so that's probably going to happen when the time comes. And I fully expect both states to do all they can to defend their state laws against these dumps. In fact, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has already spoken out, said she will do everything in her power to stop the dump targeted at New Mexico. And I fully expect the state of Texas, Governor Abbott, to do the same thing. He's made his position clear.
What kind of options are there in terms of fighting back that perhaps we, the public, can participate in?
Educating all of your government officials, whether elected or appointed, at every level of government, because when it comes to high-level radioactive waste transportation, we all live in New Mexico. We all live in Texas. We all live in Nevada. Incredibly, these licenses were granted by the NRC with the assumption that Yucca Mountain, Nevada, on Western Shoshone land, will be the permanent repository, which is an outrageous assumption. Yucca Mountain hasn't been licensed. The licensing proceeding hasn't even begun. The NRC is supposed to be the objective, unbiased, neutral judge of the Yucca Mountain licensing proceeding, which has not even begun. And apparently, they've made up their mind already that it is going to be the repository. That's how they justify this word interim in Texas and New Mexico, because it's going to go to Nevada. Well, all of us along the transportation routes to these various states, we are at risk here. They're going to move this waste through our communities in unprecedented numbers. We're talking the New Mexico dump, 10,000 shipments. And then some decade or century, when it comes time to move it to Nevada, they're going to have to transport it again. They even admit, both Interim Storage Partners and Holtec, that the only rail route going from their neck of the woods on the Texas-New Mexico borderlands is back through Texas, through Oklahoma, the same route that it came in from the east in the first place to get it to Yucca Mountain, Nevada. And so those communities in Texas and Oklahoma, like Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Fort Worth, they're going to see the waste coming in from the east, and then they're going to see it again going out to Yucca Mountain. This is an automatic doubling of transportation risks for certain communities. And Fort Worth, Texas, the 12th largest city in the country, has objected throughout these proceedings, even to the point of friend of the court briefs to the DC Circuit and to the Supreme Court, saying, we don't want these wastes coming through once, let alone twice.
There was also an issue that was explored by the activists around San Onofre, because there have been certain proposals to take out the waste from San Onofre, which is on the ocean, and if it was to be brought to an interim storage facility or Yucca Mountain, theoretically, that it would have to go by rail. And someone crunched the numbers on what the rail beds were built to be able to sustain. And given the weight not only of the fuel, but of the canisters, the weight would exceed what was safe to be carried on those rail lines. Is that an aspect that has been explored as well?
Yes, it was brought up in all of these proceedings, ignored. The Fasken Land and Minerals was focused on their neck of the woods because there's so much fossil fuel on the rails, and they're very limited rails. And yes, these high-level radioactive waste containers, the waste itself, its transportation container, even the train car carrying it, you add that all up, the containers alone, when fully loaded, will weigh 180 metric tons. And yes, there are loads on the rails that are heavier than that, like the locomotives themselves. But we're talking about the numbers here. We're talking about 10,000 shipments into New Mexico. So that repeated abuse of the rails with such heavy weights is going to take its toll We have derailments in the United States on a regular basis already due to infrastructure collapse. And so here you go with the most deadly toxic poison ever generated by human beings, high-level radioactive waste. These containers, if you listen to NRC and DOE and the industry, they're somehow impervious to anything. That is not true. The design criteria for these containers is minimal. A 30-minute fire at 1,875 degrees Fahrenheit, that is not a hot fire. There are fossil fuels that burn hotter than that, like diesel fuel, common in commerce, burns at 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit for a lot longer than 30 minutes. I mean, how long have some real world fires burned for? I mean, East Palestine was on fire for hours, I believe. And then they decided to preemptively burn the toxic chemicals to make sure they didn't explode and created an environmental catastrophe. That was a real world accident that very likely surpassed the design criteria of these high-level radioactive waste containers. And it's not just the land-based travel. There's also barging proposed for high-level radioactive waste, including on the California coast, Diablo Canyon into Oxnard, for one example. And the underwater submersion design criteria are also inadequate. Very short time periods, but these containers weigh 180 tons. So how are you going to lift it from the floor of the Pacific Ocean onto a ship in a short period of time? What if it's already been breached and is leaking radioactive waste? What if water has gotten in there and a chain reaction has sparked in the fissile material in the waste? Uranium-235, plutonium-239 could form a critical mass in the disaster, and then lifting it to the surface would be a suicide mission for the emergency responders. It's giving off gamma and neutrons like a nuclear reaction, because it is a nuclear reaction, because water serves as a neutron moderator. So these design criteria have not even been tested in the physical world at full scale. Computer modeling and scale model tests are deemed sufficient. So there's huge shortcuts being taken on safety at every turn.
What's the timeline we're looking at here? How much time do you have to prepare the next wave of fighting back? And when is that approximated to happen?
Well, those state laws are going to slow things down to some extent, hopefully. We're going to pursue our appeal at the DC Circuit at the earliest opportunity. It's been held in abeyance until the Supreme Court ruled. So now we can go back to the DC Circuit and say, well, here we are again. And one way of looking at it is, how long does it take to build dry cast storage facilities at nuclear power plants? Not very long, really. It could be a matter of months if they apply themselves. That is the proposal in West Texas, is to simply build these reinforced concrete pads, slabs, on the desert floor in West Texas and start shipping the waste out. But there are a dearth of containers for shipping this stuff. It's a very limited number. But you know, we faced a similar dump proposal in Utah 20 years ago. We stopped it. It was called private fuel storage at the Sco Valley Goshutes Indian Reservation in West Utah. Holtec was a partner to that project. They were going to supply the containers, but the owners of that project were the nuclear utility companies themselves, a dozen or 15 of them. And I was afraid, because they got a license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, just like these dumps in Texas and New Mexico have, that they were going to go so far as to simply send a single legal weight truck shipment on the interstate highways out there, plunk it on one of these pads, and like Columbus planting his flag, say, there, the dump is open. They never got away with it. We had to get really creative after that license was issued in Utah. One of the things we accomplished was the establishment of a federal wilderness area for the first time in a generation or longer in Utah, that they couldn't lay the train tracks needed to get these train-sized canisters down to the Indian reservation. But that truck route was still there. They never got away with it, though. The Mormon Church, the state of Utah, rose up, even though NRC had licensed the facility, and they never broke ground on that dump. So we're in a similar situation now, where the state of Texas, the state of New Mexico, has to continue to fight and prevent something as radical as these companies simply trucking a waste shipment in and plunking it down on a concrete pad and saying, there, our dump is now open. similar behavior by the U.S. Department of Energy took place at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant in New Mexico, just 16 miles away from the Holtec site. It's the only operating geologic repository in the world, but it's for a different category of waste. It's plutonium-contaminated military waste from the nuclear weapons complex. The DOE broke the rules to open that dump in March of 1999 because the state of New Mexico had jurisdiction over mixed waste, chemical toxins, and radioactive waste. They were not letting the dump open. So what DOE did to break the rules was they found purely radioactive waste. It was from the Cassini space launch at NASA. It was pure plutonium waste. It was not toxic chemicals in there. And they trucked it in and they delivered it to the site in March of 1999. And then they said, there, New Mexico, the dump is open, whether you like it or not. It wasn't supposed to be for NASA waste. It was supposed to be for nuclear weapons complex waste. But they did it anyway. So that's the kind of behavior that we've come to expect from the Department of Energy, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the nuclear industry writ large, and we have to be on guard against it.
Theoretical question. Are we owned by nuclear? It seems that whatever they want from government, whatever they want, they will get. And they've got the money to back it up and the persistence and the staff in order to do it. So in essence, are they in control, or do we still have some say in the matter?
That's one way to look at it, is the tail wags the dog. The nuclear industry controls our government, is our government effectively. But of course, we continue to fight back. We are not quitters. We have won some impossible victories. We stopped the Yucca Mountain dump. We have to remain vigilant on that victory to preserve it. We stopped the Skull Valley dump. We've stopped so many dumps. President Nixon gave a speech late in his tenure that he wanted to see 1,000 reactors in the United States by the year 2000. It was called Project Energy Independence. They got away with 134 atomic reactors, and it's a tragedy, but they did not get away with 1,000. That's more than 800 reactors stopped in various stages. Some of them 90% built, like Marble Hill in Southern Indiana, 90% built. 90% built Midland Nuclear Power Plant in Michigan. They were stopped nonetheless, 90% built. So we've won some impossible victories. We've moved mountains. We've achieved miracles. We've sometimes lost. And here we are in the midst of this fight. And you asked what people can do. I said, educate all of your elected and appointed government officials. Educate your neighbors, your friends, your family. We have to keep fighting this monster. I mean, the Manhattan Project, beginning in 1942, 1943, was a secret. The American people didn't even know about it until Trinity, and they covered that up. They said it was a munitions depot explosion. And then 2 weeks later, they bombed Hiroshima. And 3 days later, they bombed Nagasaki without the permission or asking the American people what they thought about any of it. It was just a fait accompli. They've continued to behave that way for 80 years now. They can do whatever they want. They can do it in secret. The American people may hear about it later, but we're not asking them. And even when the American people in various ways try to express their opinion on this matter, like in federal court or in an NRC proceeding, they're still ignored. So we have a tremendous challenge to our democracy. We have since at least the Manhattan Project. My way of looking at it is this was our ticket as a country to superpower status. And the people making the decisions wanted to be a superpower. And so the American people had no say. We have more of a say now than we did in 1945, but we're still ignored a lot of the time. Alfred Meyer says it's all about the bomb. Nuclear power is all about the bomb. And there's a lot of truth to that. The nuclear power industry has acquired a lot of power of its own. It makes a lot of money all its own, but it is the flip side of the coin with nuclear weapons. And so we're up against a very powerful industry, one of the most powerful economic and political players in our country, including campaign contributions, lobbying expenditures. That begins to explain how we can lose, even when things seem so clear cut our way. But we're not going anywhere. We're still fighting. And we hope to prevail in the end against these dumps.
Anything you'd like to add?
Just that it's kind of scary the free fall that nuclear power safety is undergoing right now. The ADVANCE Act that was passed last summer, a year ago, Trump's executive orders. I mean, between his reelection and his oath of office, which he violates on a daily basis, he rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange last November, December. And he was asked a question by a reporter about nuclear power plant licensing. And he said something like, it should only take a week. It should only take a week to license an atomic reactor. And compare that to then serving NRC chairman Christopher Hansen, who said it should take a year, which is also an absurd statement that it should only take a year to license an atomic reactor. But it was, you know, 52 times stronger than what Trump said. Well, last week, Trump fired Hansen from the NRC commission. He was still on there. He wasn't chairman anymore. He was Biden's chairman, but Trump had named a Republican chairman. And so there's this absurd notion that you can license an atomic reactor in a week or a year. And apparently Christopher Hansen was too much of a safety advocate for saying it should take a year. So Trump just fired him on a moment's notice. So we're in this terrible free fall on nuclear safety, and we have to resist it.
Kevin, it is always eye-opening, educational, somewhat terrifying, but always edifying to talk with you. And I thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kevin Camps, who is the radioactive waste watchdog for Beyond Nuclear. You can contact him to learn more at kevin@beyondnuclear.org and read some of the actions that have been taken at beyondnuclear.org.
Activists, shout out.
Happy birthday and woohoo to Felice and Jack Cohen-Joppa. They are the writers and editors of the Nuclear Resistor newsletter. They run the Nuclear Resistor news site, and Jack presents our Nuclear Resistor report, our milk and cookies time, once a month with a story of action that worked from our shared nuclear past. Their shared birthday is June 26th, this Thursday, and they invite you to mark the date by, at minimum, going to their website, nuclearresistor.org, and signing up for that newsletter. It's free, it's informative. They're great writers and terrific people who have been doing this work for a long time. Feel free to help them any way you can. And because it's always a good idea to remember actions that any one of us can take to fight against nuclear expansion, especially weapons, here is my favorite public service announcement on Don't Bank on the Bomb. It's a way to withdraw your bank from investing in those companies that manufacture parts for nuclear weapons. You'll be hearing from Susie Snyder, who is Program Coordinator of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, and she provides us with a fast rundown on a simple action any of us, and truly all of us, can and should be taking to get rid of nuclear weapons.
It's amazing. It's called Don't Bank on the Bomb, and that's the website too, don'tbankonthebomb.com. Step one, find out if your bank invests in nuclear weapon producers. Step two, contact your bank. Tell them you don't want them to. Step three, tell the world what the bank says, and if they don't get rid of investments, go public, because no bank wants to look like a bad guy. It takes one or two people only to make a huge difference, and that can cut off the money stream to the companies that make nuclear weapons. You and I, we have more power than we think, and that power is sitting in our wallet.
And how can people find out whether the companies that we're told the bank is supporting have any connection with the nuclear weapons industry?
Well, we do a significant investigation every year. Now, it's not completely exhaustive, but we profile 28 companies that have association with nuclear weapons modernization and maintenance. And it's on our website, don'tbankonthebomb.com. And we really want people to use our information and contact us all the time. You can do that in, you know, through the website really easily. Contact me on Twitter, whatever works. And I'm happy to find out more. And if you find out, learn about more companies involved in nuclear weapons, tell us. We'll do the research and we'll make it public for everybody to use.
Love it.
That was Susie Snyder, Program Coordinator for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. And she was talking about how any of us can participate in a meaningful way to get rid of nukes by being part of the Don't Bank on the Bomb program. ICAN has also just published its 2025 report on those companies producing parts for nuclear weapons, with all the footnotes, cross-references, charts, and graphs you could possibly want to support what they are saying. Hopefully, you will soon be saying a lot of this to your financial advisors and sending them to the ICAN page as well. The report, At Great Cost, The Companies Building Nuclear Weapons and Their Financiers, is a joint publication of PACS, the largest peace organization in the Netherlands and the source of the Don't Bank on the Bomb program, and ICAN. As shown in the report, between January 2022 and August 2024, 260 financial institutions had significant financing or investment relations with nuclear weapons producers. This is down from 287 institutions in the previously published results. Banks, pension funds, asset managers, and other financial institutions worldwide continue to financially back the nuclear weapons industry by calling them and asking a few simple, targeted questions, such as Susie just explained. You can begin to support the process of having them examine and question their investments on the road to divesting from those with nuclear entanglements. We will have a link to where you can download the full report and also a brief executive summary of its contents. That will be up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 730. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 24th, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or do us a favor and do it through our website. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, go to the yellow opt-in box, you cannot miss it, put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just one, with a link to that week's show, which is just posted, and a brief description of its content. That way, you never have to risk missing a single episode of this show as we move forward in this, our 15th year. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send us an email. Do it to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Thank you. And another thank you. Any amount will help us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025. Libby Halevy and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, our website, the names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevy of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as former Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev said, any fool can start a war. And once he's done so, even the wisest of men are helpless to stop it. Especially if it's a nuclear war. There you have it. This has all been your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.